shit. Oh, shit. It's going off now.
Episode 26, Highway Diaries. My guest on this episode, Quincy Jones. First thing, I just want to wrap up a quick story from last week's episode. Last week, I played a clip of Josh Nichols, who's the co-host of the Self-Indulgent Podcast, said that I wasn't funny. So I issued a challenge to him. Let's have a comedy contest. Obviously, it would be like a show. You would have a series of improv, you know, games, and then we would each do stand-up. Josh would do stand-up, and I would do stand-up. And then, you know, you would pass out ballots, and then they would vote on who's funnier. And, you know, Josh can hire D-Bolt. He can hire that vote rigging company. He can have home court advantage. It can be at his theater. All that's fine. If you're going to say I'm not funny, let's throw some statistics into the ring, okay? After getting called out, this is Josh Nichols' predictable blubbering backpedal.
Let me just say, I don't need to measure myself against him.
You don't want to?
No.
He's going to say you're afraid.
Dude. He can say whatever he wants because I have, honestly, any second I spend on him that isn't for the entertainment of this show is a wasted second.
Well, what if we did this
book?
For the show?
What, dude, what for the show? I stand to gain nothing.
Right.
So
you decline?
No, I genuinely decline.
Wow.
I don't know what a humor off is.
Highway Diaries is a series of audio lectures giving you a doctorate in fucking street smarts, okay? So I don't need to further explain what has happened. Maybe I mention it once or twice, but here's Quincy Jones.
I tasted my own semen. I get like 10, 12 bitches. It's impossible to hate me. No condom, baby. I can change a tire.
This is the Highway Diary podcast. I'm sitting here with my main man, Quincy Jones.
What's going on, guys?
Open mic extraordinaire. You know, every time I've been saying Quincy Jones, but everyone's going, the record producer. And I say my name, and they're like, holler back. It's all about, but you know, whatever. Yeah. We're cursed.
We're cursed with great names.
Yeah.
They
are a cross to bear. So, I've seen you, you know, we've been seeing each other around the open mic circuit, mm-hmm. You know. I love your shit. My favorite joke, I'm sorry to blow up, just it's very not polite just to go, mm-hmm. But you know, who's your spirit animal? If you had a spirit animal,
Silver Lake Hipster, that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, so my spirit animal is a Silver Lake Hipster,
but I could see it makes total sense looking at you. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
you're a black guy, but your style is Silver Lake Hipster, whatever.
Yeah, I try, man, just try and be versatile.
I saw you at a Flappers Comedy Lab, you know, that on Sundays at 4, they have this thing where comedians come in and they just kind of do try shit in front of each other and critique each other. I saw there's this guy, Peter, who is a comic and works at, and you took his notes up on, and you did stand up with his notes.
Yeah.
Tell me about what was going on there.
You know, I believe in all about being in the moment, you know, I believe in just feeling free. I feel like when you're in the moment, you're the most free. So, for me, I just wanted to see if I could make something funny. Like, not no, it's
yeah,
like,
yeah,
it
yeah.
was like it was like a poor riff off the show set list out here, you know. So
yeah, no, that's cool. I think you know, I also come from an improv background. You know, I started at UCB, and I've only been doing stand up for 4 months. So whenever I see someone try something like that, I'm like, hell yeah! It's in the spirit of what we're doing here.
Yeah,
because you know, a lot of people like. Sometimes, like, the first time people see stand-up, they think that it's all improvised and that, you know, the bits aren't honed, you know, over thousands of hours of doing the same joke over and over.
Right. But I think that's the best part of comedy, like, is when it seems effortless.
Yeah.
You don't know. Everyone's like, does that comic write? Well, this comic doesn't write. No, everyone writes. I was just telling that to my friend. Everyone writes. It may not be like, sit down, let me dim the lights, let me get my music on. And it's like, if you write down in your notepad on your iPhone, that's writing.
So. I don't know, I'm weird. I always have this, like, obsessive thing where I have to print out my entire act, I read it 3 times, and then I completely forget it, and then I go on stage. That's kind of my thing. I write it word for word, how I think it should be ideally said, and then I fall short of that, but I get myself in the moment, you know, by just having it like, well, I know how this bit goes, so I'm just going to try and say it for you.
That's how I do it. Like, I have, like, just the line... the phrasing that I want to get out, mm-hmm. or the wording. Like, I might fine-tune it. Because for me, any joke that works consistently, I've worked really hard in forging it. And it's like, whether it's building it word by word, fine-tuning it all the way. So, yeah.
Yeah. You talk about mushrooms on stage a lot.
Yeah, I talk about mushrooms. Yeah.
You know, hallucinogenic mushrooms. I've been talking about that earlier on the podcast. How do you think that hallucinogens has informed your comedy? Or how hallucinogenic mushrooms specifically, what have you got from that?
I love mushrooms. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the problem with any drug is moderation. You know, right. I think every drug has, it was meant for a positive place, you know, yeah. And people don't know how to, you know, moderate that. That being said, mushrooms, I feel like for my comedy, it's expanded my brain, expanded the way to look at things. Like, I write an obscure things, like, I have a joke about GPS or childproof locks or certain inventions, stuff like that. So,
I've only done mushrooms once, you know.
Yeah. But, what'd you think about it?
I thought I saw like a pulsing of whatever the god vibration is, like this like pulsing love vibration, mm-hmm. you know, of this,
like a ray emanating from each person, basically.
Yeah. And from all living things. Like, I saw geometric patterns blasting off of plants, as it's like, that's its encoded DNA, but it's like this source of the life energy.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, you know, anyone who tries to write what God is into a book, kind of, and make it into a frame, it's kind of, and then it's like this thing that needs to be worshipped. I don't think that's what it is. I think that there is this, like, positive vibration of intelligence, but I don't know how to define it, really.
I think that's the best part about it. It's like, the way I define shrooms, or like explaining something while on shrooms, is, you know, in the movie Ratatouille, you ever seen that movie?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
It's about the mouse
which is a chef, cooks, right?
Okay.
Anyways, he's trying to describe the palate to his brother, who's just a regular rat, and he doesn't share the same passion. And, like, the brother closes his eyes and he sees, like, glimmers of, like, okay. But in the end, he can't see it for whatever reason. And that's what I feel like with shrooms is, like, when you close your eyes, like, the more you let yourself open to it, the more you're going to be open to different interpretations of everyday things. Plants, you saw DNA structure.
Yeah.
Energy readings, you know what I'm saying? Stuff like that.
So, I mean, mostly I've been an atheist, you know, I grew up a Catholic, and that's a quick way to atheism, because they're like, oh, no, believe everything that we think, you know, and then the guy's like, hey, little kid, come here, you know, it's fucked up, so, like, I'm not following this guy, but, you know, and then I took mushrooms, and I experienced something, I felt my body get in touch with some kind of greater consciousness, and then I went, wait a minute, I don't know. I think that's the right answer of, like, is there a God or isn't there a God? There's a correct answer.
Yeah.
It's I don't know because my mind is too small and I'm limited by sensories. But
I can believe it, like, I can concede to agnosticism.
Okay.
Agnostics, whatever they call it. I can concede to them. Like, they just don't want to call it God. And what they don't want to call it God is because they don't want the stories from the Bible. They want this man-made interpretation based on something higher than them. You know? So they don't want to attribute that to any particular religion or name. So they're like, there's a higher power out there. Atheism is saying that there's nothing higher than that. That's kind of cocky. That's kind of cocky, you know?
They're like, we have the answer, and science has proven that the answer is no.
Yeah.
It's like, what, you know, even the internet has expanded people's minds like at a psychedelic pace where it's like, no, now you can know anything ever.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't know everything, you're lazy because you have access to it. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's like it's a different frame. You know, not everyone knows the Dewey fucking decimal system, but everyone can type in, you know, Nazi to Google or whatever and see what they're about. You know? Oh yeah, I saw something on Facebook that you posted. You posted a picture of, you said, "Hey, look at these trolls on the bus," and it was two very, I mean, some of the fattest people. It's hard to categorize them as a human person because of the level of their obesity.
Yeah.
So, But at the same time, I have mixed feelings about that, because whenever you're seeing a movie, you know, and they go, oh, and oh, I went on a date with an absolute dog. She was so ugly. And then they show an actual actress playing that part. I have an anxiety attack.
Okay.
I feel like I cannot believe that someone is just standing there as the ugly person. You know, it gives me the fucking... I feel crippled by it.
Is it empathy? Okay, so you have a high empathy level.
I just don't like that.
You don't?
Like, this person maybe is the judgment? Fucking ugly. Yeah.
Maybe you don't like the fact that someone's passing judgment and someone unknowingly.
Yeah, exactly.
They're unknown to it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Because, you know, someone might find that person attractive.
Right.
They're going, no, we are Hollywood. We are telling you what's attractive. And this is attractive. And that person is a fucking dog. And they're just standing there taking what Hollywood is giving to them.
Right.
I don't know. But at the same time, when I looked at the people that you posted on the bus, I giggled because they were monsters. So I'm on both sides of the fence here.
Yeah, man. I guess you guys had to see the pic. But
yeah, go to Quincy Jones' Facebook.
Go to Quincy Jones' Facebook and see those pictures. And you're gonna,
you know, hit Control F and write trolls, and you'll find these people.
Dude, man, they were like dressed up, and it was weird at that time. That was right there. It's crazy.
It's gothed out. And if you're on hallucinogenic mushrooms and you see really people who put such an effort on their looks and no effort on their body, you know what I mean?
Right.
Someone will spend 6 hours putting makeup all over them, their fat self. You know,
those are the worst.
It's like there's other ways, you know, to improve your looks. The makeup.
Well, sometimes not even their looks.
It's called a treadmill.
Sometimes it's their personality. I think that's what makeup does, is like conceal how ugly or insecure our personalities are. Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm just feeling it.
Right? No, yeah, I like what you're saying.
Like makeup, like it's all we're just trying to conceal is personality or insecurities about our personality. And it's like the more you dress it up on the outside, the less likely people are to think how ugly you might be on the inside. Mm. So, I don't know. I really could be.
What do you think about the backlash of hipster hate? You know, like there's people who really hate on hipsters for their effort on their appearance and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone does, but I definitely think hipsters try too hard, if you will.
Okay.
Like to.
But hipsters are your spirit animal.
Well, I mean, not seriously my spirit animal, but like,
it's a fucking joke.
I mean,
asshole.
I think being aware, but there are people who get these obscure tattoos that like, yeah, like I saw the depth in the brave little toaster, and it's like. No, you didn't, dude. There was no like more, and they're like trying to be better. Than the people around us by thinking that, oh, because I look at this differently than most, like, I'm better. And, like, you're not. Like, no one's better than anybody. We're all equals. I could be just as ugly as the trolls I posted on the picture. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like...
On the inside.
Yeah, on the inside. You know, but we're all equals. I don't look at anybody above or beneath me. I would look at Chris Rock and be like, oh, my gosh. I've grown up watching. You're amazing. No, we're still equal.
Yeah.
You know, Barack, you know, I mean, granted, I would never come to those arenas, but, you know, we wouldn't be in the same vicinity, but...
But it's like, you know, the effort it takes, who knows if the effort it takes to be, like, considered, like, a Chris Rock or someone who's considered the funniest person in the world, that person is working probably way harder than a politician is. Politician, you know what they're doing? Reason up with each other, moneying up, you know, selling people's souls and doing satanic rituals, and that's what they're doing.
I love how you threw that little curve. He's like, yeah, they're greasing up, all about the money, not looking out for the common man, and doing satanic rituals. Get all serious in the satanic rituals.
Because I, you know, I love all this stuff about conspiracies of the Illuminati and how there's people who, you know, I get caught up in thinking that maybe, you know, the superstructure of, you know.
So you believe there's an Illuminati? You believe that there's a secret society being
controlled?
Maybe,
but then again, I also don't know. I don't fucking know. You know why? Because I'm not there. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's. I guess that's all about. It's not about also what you know, but what you feel, like what you think. Like those are just as important as what I know. Like if you're like the sky is blue, I was like, I think it's red. And you're like, well, I can't
really aren't. Like, I mean, at this point, it's either a breakdown of language and interpretation. Yeah. You know, but it's like, do you think there's people out there controlling things? Like, certain things are aligned? And yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Isn't that just what politics is?
I don't think politics is also the Illuminati. I think the people behind the politicians, which have the ulterior agendas. Why did this bill get passed but not that bill? Why is gay marriage not legal? What's the motive behind that? Why? Because it would change everything.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who are gay undercover. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Maybe they haven't been in an environment, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. So gay marriage might twinge with them. They're like, no, you know, it's just, I might get me, a, I don't know. I believe in the Illuminati, though, for sure.
Yeah.
I believe the media is a tool of the Illuminati, I think.
Politics. It's like, what is the Illuminati? If you look at the Federal Reserve, okay, there are people who own the basis of what money is. Okay, right. Those are private banks. Okay, you don't think the owner of a private bank that owns the value of what the U.S. currency is, and then it's like their portfolio is not like a couple shares of Apple stock. Their portfolio is like chaos energy. Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean? Look at what they're doing. Look at what they're doing. And go, and they're keeping the conversation to gay marriage because it's a petty fucking, because the gay marriage argument was settled, pursuit of freedom, or, you know, pursuit of happiness. Yeah. The gay marriage debate is over. Mm-hmm. People can do whatever the fuck they want. And mm-hmm. that's the basis of what America is. And that's, so freedom is. It's like, you know, but they put that argument out there so that, you know, that you don't see what they're, what the real shit is doing, anything that matters.
Yeah.
You know. If we are all equal, then someone who is born into money and does nothing to earn it, like someone like the Queen of England,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then she's...
I don't even know how they got into... Like, it seems like it's been a royal family for years, isn't it, right? Like it just seems always. So it's like, how did you even get there?
And there's just some tremendous levels of incest to keep all that money in this bloodline.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Because they're marrying each other's cousins to reconsolidate, you know? And then they're just marrying other kings, and then you have to prove that you have the most incest, and then you're the purest one. You know, there's other people with a lot of royal blood out there, but I guess Queen Elizabeth has proven she has the most of this royal blood, you know? And what the fuck in their heads do they think that blood, what makes that blood special? Do they think that they're the descendants of Jesus Christ or something like this? You know, what the...
Well, then maybe they're the descendants of famous knights or something in London, I don't know. That's crazy. That's making me think about something I normally wouldn't think about, like... Why do they think that their blood is more superior?
Isn't that what racism is?
Yeah, I mean...
You know?
Yeah, well, racism is like the negative stereotypes being perpetuated about it, which I don't think, like, if you think about any stereotype, there might be some truth to it at some point, but it's like, for it to become a stereotype, for it to have that much, like, influence on a person's outlook on another human race, like... Oh, all white Jews are whiny. Well, yeah, there might be a lot of white Jews who are whiny. But am I going to think that every Jew that's white? Yeah. That's ridiculous. That's mm-hmm. ignorance being repressed. That's all stereotypes are. It's like a few examples, you know, that might have been seen a couple times, now become a stereotype. You know?
Yeah.
What if not all Jewish moms are pushing their kids to get married and have kids? Come on, Eric, you're getting to be a... It's a bad impression of a Jewish mom. Come on, Eric, you're getting to be a... Uh-huh. I want a baby. And you're like... Well, what if most of them are like, cool, like, hey, whatever makes you happy, keep it up, you know? Mm-hmm. Do whatever you want. Like, I support you, right here. It's weird to think that stereotype of the Jewish mom...
Well, actually, I feel like I have to clarify. I am not Jewish. I was raised Catholic, you know, but you know, I see what you're saying. You just made my mom like a Jewish mom, right?
I don't know. That's a stereotype. Right? I don't even know why I thought to last name.
Because of the nose.
The nose. I don't know the Jewish nose is. What if Pinocchio was a Jew?
I think so. Yeah. And just like a Jew, he lied a lot. So that was the problem. Stereotypes.
It's crazy. It's crazy to even think that that's those stereotypes are what we even think about. Oh man, it's deep, man. It's deep.
Something that's been. I want to change the subject here.
What's that?
I want to talk about something. At the beginning of this podcast, I actually played a clip of someone by the name of Josh Nichols saying that I wasn't funny. Okay, on a different podcast that I frequently. Now, keep in mind, I've said a lot of shit on him too. Okay, then he says I'm not funny. So I challenged him at the beginning of this podcast to a fucking stand-up and improv competition. He is the leader of this improv group called Cherry Spitz.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'll challenge you to a fucking improv contest. I'm going to challenge you to a stand-up contest as well. Well, so you want to call me not funny? And he's a comedian. Let's fucking go. So anyway, I called in earlier today to the podcast and issued my challenge, and he declined.
Well, why do you think he declined?
He declined because he knows I'm going to fucking light him up. Okay. And I said, I also said, I'll do it at your theater. Because they were saying, well, you know, Eric might want to do it at Flappers because he has own field advantage there versus Spectacles Improv, which is the theater that he goes to. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we'll do it in your fucking house, man. I'll go to your house. You think I'm scared of a fresh audience who hasn't heard my jokes before, who are ready for a comedy show? Yeah. Let's fucking do this. Anyway, I'm sorry. But
no, like, what set you off?
When someone says who's a comedian, you're not funny. Or that's like a boxer going, oh, you punch like a girl. Well, you're a boxer, I'm a boxer. Let's fucking fight and settle this if you're going to talk shit.
Yeah.
And then he declined. You know what I mean? This whole situation gets me fired up. It gets me aggravated.
Well, that's good, but it's like you're getting angry and it's like... It's like, and it's right, I get it, you know, but I deeper now, mm-hmm. I think it's like, maybe you just don't like the concept of judgment, like someone judging.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
maybe
yeah.
Maybe that's playing out, like, so for this guy, you're sitting there unaware, and he's looking at you while you're trying to work on your craft.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's like saying, oh, you're not funny. He passed judgment up on you.
Yeah.
And you don't like okay. Like, honestly, if someone said I wasn't funny, I'll tell you a true story. When I first started out, there was a comic I looked, well, we were peers. I was elder in age, and I say funny, but he was more comfortable on stage, and he was younger my years, right? So there's those dynamics going
on. Yeah, of course.
And he looks at me, and like we're talking, and he says to me, no one's really, like you're not getting booked because people think you don't have material. They think all you do is riff. And I was like, whoa. And it threw me for a loop. So I went home feverishly, wrote everything down. Joke. But for someone to pass judgment about me, it was like, that's your opinion? Now I'm to the point where it's like, oh, you just don't like my type of comedy. Mm-hmm. You don't do what I do. And it's different. And that intimidates you. So you feel the need to push it down beneath you.
Yeah.
Because everyone's fear of the unknown. Yeah. So people are like, Eric Hollerbach guy, he's not funny. He's just that and the third. It's like, okay. So you're not used to my type of comedy.
Right.
You're not used to my type of stuff. I get that. You know? Yeah. Like, I get that.
Yeah.
Now I get why you're trying to push it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if someone's like, Quincy, same thing. You know? Okay, that's cool. You don't know what I do. You're not familiar with it. So that's why you're judging it.
Yeah.
And people judge towards the negative when they don't know.
Yeah.
They're looking at it. They might have seen you one time do one thing where you didn't do well. You might have 99 other times where you're doing great.
Yeah.
Then it's like... But they saw it one time. They're like, "Oh, I don't like this. I don't like what this is doing. I'm not used to seeing that. Go ahead and change, and then I'll give you a better judgment." Fuck that. Comedy. If I don't like your type of comedy, I'll say I don't like your type of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, if I don't think that you're putting in the hours that it takes to get better, you know, I'm a huge believer of the outsiders, 10,000 hours, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'll explain that's why I'm doing 1,000. But
yeah.
It's like. Like, yeah, you can't call someone anything. You can't label anybody a negative adjective.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you're this. You're slow. What am I supposed to be?
Yeah.
I'm 6 foot 230 and out of shape. I'm not supposed to be dashing Usain Bolt. You know what I'm saying? Like, why are you thinking this? Yeah. Oh, that person's not smart. In what capacity are you measuring intelligence now?
Yeah.
You think it's an aptitude test? You think it's about that? Really? Like, what are you... what are you, crazy?
Like, I feel, here's the thing, I feel I'm definitely not, you know, clinically balanced. If a psychologist went through my podcast, they would, they would give me a cocktail and they would say, you have to take, like, horse tranquilizing lithium, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Probably, but, you know, I have a fire in my belly, and that's what makes me fucking work hard. What do you think about this? If someone calls you out and says, hey, let's have a stand-up contest, who's funnier? I don't know. Would you accept or decline?
What? I wouldn't even know how that would happen. Just get us randomly in front of a bunch of people? That's all about who's more likable, you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
If you are a Marc Maron type comic,
yeah,
and I'm a Chris D'Elia type comic.
Right.
There's such contrast if people are gonna go for the.
No, you're absolutely so, right. You're absolutely right.
But if someone's like, yo, I don't think Quincy's funny, I want to challenge him to a comedy contest. You goddamn right, I take it. Just because I'm a competitor, like that's, I'm not gonna let anyone. You're gonna tell me that what I work as hard as I work.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
don't think
exactly.
I'm funny? No way. Prove that.
Yeah.
Prove it to me that you're as funny as you think you
you're
are.
You're getting fired up, and this is how I feel.
Yeah, it's that, you know. I don't know. It's fucking
saying those two words. It's like all we're doing. And here's the thing. And it's also discounting, just dismissing with two fucking words, like. The word's not funny.
Yeah.
There's so many different interpretations, as we've been saying, of what funny is. So he's saying that there's no audience for what I'm... Like not funny. Those two words means no one finds you funny.
Yeah.
And that's like...
And that's so final. And the finality.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's all done.
It's done. Forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
This person is not funny. You say that, that is an incantation that makes me pissed off.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. I get that part now. Now you're talking about something I love. I love comedy. It's my
That's
dream.
All I do. That's yeah. all I ever do. You have any idea? Like, I'm you know, I don't know. I don't want to, like, throw a bunch of credentials down, but it's like, all I do is comedy. If he looks at, you know,
that's good. I like it when the fires. Don't douse it out. Don't fucking be real.
I feel like sometimes I feel like dousing it out is so that I don't, like, murder someone in a... No, I'm just joking. Mm-hmm. You can't even talk like that after Boston Marathon. You know?
Yeah, you can.
You can't. You definitely can't say, I feel like...
I feel like blowing up Boston. You can't say that. Like, oh, fucking the accents. God.
Yeah. I used to do this, we talked about on the podcast. I would be on the phone with my sister. And I'd be like, are you listening, CIA? Al-Qaeda, trying to set off trigger words. You know, Al-Qaeda, bomb, nuclear, 9/11. Mm-hmm. Are you listening, CIA? Fuck you, CIA. Get a fucking job, you asshole. Because I sit on it, oh, I'm a police officer. I sit in a cubicle and listen to other people's conversations.
You think the CIA,
I think it's it's known that the technology's out there where when people are on the phone and they yell keywords, they say Al-Qaeda, they say some ridiculous number of, you know,
yeah.
Hot phrases, bomb away. Then they can, and the say clicks in and starts listening.
That's crazy. It almost, wow.
It's like, that's like the warrant. That's like the judge signing the warrant is you saying Al-Qaeda.
Wow.
Fact. He's a terrorist.
So what? So this major builder just got passed, a CISPR or whatever? What's that? What's that all about?
They're also, like, building a giant, like, basically external hard drive to keep everyone's information on file, you know, when, and it's like electronically it'll click on and start recording your conversations, and then you can say, oh, let me see what Quincy Jones has been saying on the phone, pull up your file and all those clips of them. Probably 100% of all your phone calls. You know, it's like what they say they can do and what they're actually doing is, oh, so I can just record? Yeah, well, who's gonna fuck? You know, if it's all computers doing it, who the fuck is gonna police that shit? You know?
That. Blew my mind, man.
Illuminati.
Yeah.
Who's okaying this shit? Who's going, I'm swearing that I have the will of the people in my fucking mind, and then computers are. You know, like there's a super grid of surveillance that they're building.
Yeah, like eagle eye shit. Eagle eye shit.
Anyway,
I feel that. I mean,
it's time to get paranoid, people.
Yeah, what if that really was a segment of the podcast? Prepare to get paranoid.
I get it, though. You know, I get it. When you see what, when you really get into mainstream news and then you really get into conspiracy news, it is like the negative of a fucking photograph. It's like you dip into the matrix and then, like, all the words that come out of mainstream news suddenly have all these meanings. Yeah. And, yeah, maybe it's the paranoid delusions of this hive of conspiracy theorists, but they agree on a lot of shit, you know? Anyway, sorry, I'm just going off on a... This should be an interview, and I want to talk to you about your goal, your mission from whatever the love energy of the universe is when you're on hallucinogenic mushrooms is. You're doing 1,000 mics this year. Tell me about
1,000 sets. 1,000 sets. 1,000 sets. I do shows, too. I don't want people to think I'm not counting shows. Like, maybe at 1,200, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, 1,000 sets. I feel like if I get up 1,000 times
in a year,
then I'm going to be funnier than what I started out as.
Yeah.
I'm going to be stronger.
Yeah.
I'm going to be more prepared. 1,000. What if I did 1,000 hours every year? That's 10,000 hours right there. Assuming sets translate that. Another thing, if I write and get up like as much as I'm doing, I'll have a new hour at the end of a year. Let's say I get 5 new minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Just 5 new minutes of material. That's not
every
hard.
Month?
Every month. Let's say. I'm not like trying to find 5 new minutes at work. But I'll have a new hour.
Yeah.
That's a great way to like assuming I ever make it to that level where I have specials. And let's say I really want to do a good special a year. Yeah, I'd fucking do it. Dude, yeah. Like, I'm only getting better in, like, a big number way, though. So I'm going to be better in a bigger way than if I did, I just want to do 100
You're fucking measuring it. It's measurable.
Yeah, but I'm not defining it. Like, you can measure success. You can measure growth, but you can't define it. You know what I'm saying? Like, So, like, I really feel like 1,000 is a quality number. It's a big number. 1,000 of anything. If I did 1,000 push-ups... It's a big thing, you know?
Yeah.
So, if I jacked off 1,000 times, I'd be the best jack-offer.
You'd have a gallon of fucking success.
You know? Yeah, and that's it.
Results.
Define success. Results. Results. That's a key word. That's a key word. Results, guys. Yeah. Not success.
If you go out there
results.
And you're trying to get results and achieve a gallon of cum, you can do that. You can make that your mission and you can achieve it.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, what's your writing process and like how much new stuff do you want to do? You know what I'm saying? Like, how do you have everything categorized on your computer, you know, all your material? How do you get that done?
I have, you want to see my joke book?
Yeah, sure.
You got a
physical joke book.
Yeah, I physically have a joke book. This is my joke book.
Yeah, that is quite a monstrosity. It's got a bunch of different papers shoved in the side of it. It's got, like, just a leather bounding of many napkins and things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy, because that is what's in there. This is just writing down ideas, premises, and they might not ever see light of day again. It might not.
You might just do it, and then...
But I also might just memorize it, and just like store it in my brain.
Yeah,
and like later, if anything triggers it, boom! Like, and that's what maybe riffing seems.
Yeah. Like, of course.
The guy who told me I don't have all I do is riff. I was like, what are you saying? I don't have material. I don't have shit.
What am I saying? Well, I'm riffing. I'm just coming up with everything I'm saying right now off the top of my head. Do you not know what fucking stand up comedy is, asshole?
Yeah. Fucking.
But it's these, and you know, it's these little things that you realize, you internalize, and then turn into work output. You know, you were saying it made you write harder. For me, do you know how fucking motivated I would be? I'd be running upstairs. I'd be drinking eggs. I'd be doing 5 mics a week. No, coming up, training like a fucking samurai, getting 2 hours sleep a night, eating sardines and rice out of a thing, and then jogging, and then, you know, I'm gonna take your ass out.
I got the Rocky reference to drinking eggs, but he's like eating rice and sardines.
I'm just trying to weird homeless samurai character.
Oh, my homelessness is better than yours.
Just like going on a pier and kicking pigeons' heads off, like one by one.
Oh my God, it's so hilarious. Oh my God, it's so funny. And this is going to the internet. It's going to be released on iTunes.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear this.
Do you have a website or anything?
I have one. It's www.thatsnotquincyjones.com.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's that. And that's my website and gets access to my blog. I have a blog.
You post where your shows are coming up and stuff?
No, I don't, because I get booked in such short notice. There's never really been a show that I've known about more than 2 weeks out.
Yeah.
it's crazy. It sucks, really, but it's kind of...
Do you have Twitter?
Yeah. Random Q Jones. Follow me on Twitter. Random Q Jones.
Random website. Q Jones.
Random Q Jones, because I tweet random shit.
Yeah, and not that Quincy Jones.
Yeah, that's Calm. Yeah, that's right. Get it.
So if you get on the Random Q Jones Twitter feed, you're going to get some random shit. He's got a thought will go in his head, it'll go on Twitter, and then you'll just get a little flavor of Quincy in your coffee in the morning, you know?
Yeah, that's all I go for. I'm at set 303.
303
in the year.
So it is April 28th?
27th, right?
So are you on track? That sounds like you could make 1,000 by...
I'm behind by 45. I'll get up.
Yeah.
I'll do it. I just don't want that number to get...
What's the most amount of mics you've ever done in one day?
Six.
Oh!
Six, guys.
Dude, that is no fucking joke, man.
No.
When you just, you know, getting cross town, the traffic here is retarded. So, like, you're hitting six mics. How do you do it? Are you taking the sewer system, or what are you doing?
Mike, man! Just going and climbing up ladders in the...
Yeah. Doing parkour shit.
Right. I'm at this mic! I plan out all, I know how far west I could go and make it back. I know how far east I can go, north, south. So, for me, it's like, oh... If I go hit the Santa Monica mic, they're all great mics out of Westside Comedy Theater, not going to make it back in time to get to these three mics.
Yeah.
But these three mics, I can get all. Mm-hmm. Be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to be a master strategist.
Yeah, you also got to, figure out, hey, can I really get there in time? Because a lot of it is about waiting.
Yeah.
It's about
getting there at fucking as soon as the sign up sheet goes in. You can tell all the comedians are eyeballing it from across the room. Right. As soon as it's put on a table, it gets swarmed, And you gotta have the timing to be there when you need to be. Mm-hmm. And then, also not go insane by just waiting for hours and hours and every mic, because then you can't get up on fucking six. Mm-hmm. It's an art form. Yeah. Getting in there, getting it done.
It really is. It really is, man. It really is.
Who's a master at that? Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones is a master of nothing. I'm not even a master of procrastination. I'm pretty good at it, but not. I just do it at the end of the day. Like, you'll be closer to being your goal, which is, I think we'll also be trying to be funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's just my goal, is to entertain. I don't care. I just want to be able to entertain people. I want people to be like, you entertain people so good, I want to pay you for it.
Yeah.
Because every time I let you entertain, you do such a great job, I'm going to pay you to entertain.
Yeah.
That's what being a comedian is about to me. I want to get paid to do that.
Yeah.
I want someone to be like, here is the keys to all these people's minds.
Uh-huh.
Do what you will.
Yeah, it's very spiritual almost. Do you think it comes from just a need of attention? Like, what is that? Is there a psychological disorder accompanying being a comedian?
I think there's certain strengths, characteristic traits for sure that definitely all align. Yeah, I think that. I think it might be a lack of attention, lack of not feeling heard.
Yeah.
You have something you want to say. Everyone else is saying around you, but they're not really speaking for you. say it. Yeah. You know, that's what stand-up is. You're saying what you think. If you don't agree, if a crowd doesn't agree with what I think, I'm open to that. Mm-hmm. I can honestly, I can sit back and critique my own comedy and be like, am I a really hard-working comic? Yes. Am I funny? Yes. Can I? Is there room for improvement? Am I being funny? Yes. I can be consistently funny. That's what I'm going for now. So let me go ahead and work towards that. Now, if someone just looked at me and was like, that's never going to work, the finality of that statement, the finality would enrage me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you mean that's never going to work?
Yeah.
That's how we've progressed as humanity. Someone said, that's never going to work. Some guy's like, yeah, the fuck it will. Like, they look back and like, okay, yeah, it will.
Yeah.
Look at all the fucking events. We have a car. You think someone didn't tell Ford that's never going to work?
Yeah.
Nothing's going to go faster than a horse. You know, like, there's everything we have. It's just because someone said, I'm going to do what you're saying I can't. And even if I'm not, if I'm competitive enough, I will become. That's going to be tweeted. That's dope. That's inspirational right there. I sense the common theme with you, Eric, is judgment. You have a disdain for judgment.
But I go after people, too, so it's completely hypocritical.
That's okay, though.
Right.
That's okay. That's like saying we feed a homeless person and they have a preference, and we're like, why can't you just be grateful? Like, that's natural. Right, you know what I'm saying?
They have a preference.
Yeah, they have we're all hypocrites. I'm a hypocrite. I'm a hypocrite. There are days I don't want to get up. There are days that, like, I labeled myself the hardest working comic in LA, but it's like there are days I don't want to get up.
Yeah, it's hard, man.
I just really want to chill.
Yeah.
I just want to fuck around, you know? And then, like, I can't. I can't do that.
Because you have this lofty goal.
This lofty goal?
It's the sacrifice of being a fucking samurai.
That's exactly what it is. But I know what I am. Mm-hmm. So whatever you judge me, whatever you label me as, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. No, I mean, also, like, culturally, I feel, I think a lot about this, too. Like, I'm from the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And I feel like on the East Coast, it's all about, like, it's just more confrontational. We're very competitive with each other. It's like if you're playing Pictionary, you're gonna fucking, you want to fucking win.
Yeah.
And if you're playing, you know, whatever, you want to win. And people call each other. You know, I'm from Jersey. People, you know, it's like the Jersey people just yell at each other and scream at each other and try to like get one over on each other. So when you mix that with a competitive nature, and then someone calls you out, it's like, let's do this. I don't know. It's just cultural. I'm just very. Like, and from my culture's perspective is, I'm calling bullshit. I'm calling on your bullshit. You know, that's very big. People always have bullshit, and people always love calling them on it. It's like national holidays on the East Coast.
They always will. I mean, it's all about how you do it, though, too.
Yeah.
You know, like, if someone's pulling me to the side, one of them be like, Quinto, I don't think that joke's funny, you should get rid of it. I'm like, all right, that's cool.
Yeah.
I dig it.
Yeah.
I thank you for taking the time. To
what I have in my head is a bunch of demons, and I've attached them to the sled, and I've marched them in a certain direction.
Yeah.
In one direction. Comedy superiority.
That's what it is, man. It's all about what you really is. All right.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
I'm sorry.
Quincy fucking Jones.
Thank you. Can I bother you for a ride to Rock Paper?
Of course, yeah. Okay, absolutely. Great. Alright, let's fucking do this.
Alright, we're out of here, guys. Thank you. I'm Quincy Jones. This is Eric Hollerbach. What's the name of the podcast?
Highway Fucking Diary.
Highway Fucking Diary, guys.
It's been Highway Diary. I've been your host, Eric Hollerbach.
Highway Diary.
Thanks for my guest, Quincy Jones.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Highway Motherfucking Diaries continues. I'm sitting here with my main man, Edward Ramiro.
Hey.
What's going on, man?
Well, geez, I don't know. What's going on with you?
Well, you're a humble man, but you've directed films. You're always writing films. You started out in the army, and then you were kind of transitioned from the army to living in Germany for a while, doing music. Then you wanted to follow your Hollywood dreams. Fill me in. Fill in the gaps. What am I missing?
Well, all right. I don't know if I started out necessarily in the army. That sounds like I was born there or something.
Yeah. Okay.
Geez, I guess I've had about half a dozen different sort of lives. Lives.
Exactly.
Lives, yeah. yeah, I don't know. What do you want to talk about? I mean, it's true. I just realized something, though. It's going to be, in September, it's going to be 10 years since I've been in L.A., which kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, it's 4 for me, and it's like...
See, when I came out here, this is the problem with Los Angeles.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See, when I came out here, when I left Germany, I left a really sweet job there, and...
what were you doing?
I was teaching soldiers how to play video games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was...
You're basically, you explained it to me, you were putting these hyper-realistic, like... laser, they would basically shoot each other with guns and play laser tag, only the guns would be shooting blanks, so it'd be really intense and loud and stuff. Yeah,
well, yeah, that's one aspect of it, like one rung of the way the simulation works, because I without going into crazy details,
because
on
this
it,
is classified,
so some of it is, so, yeah, some of it. I no longer have a top secret clearance, so but. Well, yeah, so basically, there's a giant video game, like everything's pumped into this server, so the guys out in the field with their laser tag guns are shooting each other, like, in real time, and then that information is sent back through satellites into the, you know, mainframe, and generals are watching these giant maps, you know, and they're making decisions, like, oh, send these guys in, and it all kind of works together, and...
they're just simulating gunfights.
Yes, that's what they're doing.
That's so badass. That sounds really fun.
It's a pretty cool job. Like I said, the pay was really good, and my, I guess what you call quality of life over there was pretty crazy. I mean, yeah, it was Germany, and I was there for 6 years, and I loved it over there. I had this apartment that I was actually making money on because of the rent that I was paying on it. I was actually making $200 a month on the apartment because of what they were paying me to live. Mm-hmm. And it was this 3-bedroom palace that had these, like, everything was hardwood floors, and the bathroom was all stone cut and glass block. And it had these 2 balconies that overlooked this Buddhist garden with a stream running through it and goldfish swimming in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was crazy.
You're like a mob boss.
Yeah, it was nuts. And I was making $200 a month on that apartment. So then I came to L.A. to, like, move into a tiny, tiny little, like, one-bedroom apartment and pursue screenwriting. That was a real smart smart move.
Well, it depends what kind of life you leave. It depends what's important in your life.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose.
But you made a movie. Film director over here. Film director, fucking alert. Butterfly. It's your feature film. Tell me about Butterfly.
Yeah, Butterfly. Well, that movie, geez, you know, it's finally available on, I guess, all the stuff that stuff is normally available on.
Amazon.
You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at places they sell. Yeah, so places they sell movies.
If you, you know, want to watch a movie from a guy who's had 10 lives, one of them was being a mob boss in Germany. For the army, because that's a job in the army. You pick up Butterfly from fucking Amazon by Edward E. Romero.
There you go.
So tell me about Butterfly. What? It's a horror movie.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know if it's a horror movie or not. I mean, it's been called, like, I guess we were throwing around the term psychological thriller.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, you know, the festivals we were in, we would submit festivals, and a lot of the feedback that we got from festivals, we submitted to a bunch of horror festivals, and you know, and the ones that we got into still sort of, like, complained a little bit that, well, it's not really a horror movie, but, you know, we liked it or whatever. And then all the, you know, because they would think it's too indie, it's too talky, you know, like it's a little indie talky film, like, you know, an art film, really. And so then, you know, and then the people who would normally watch an art film, my response from that crowd was, well, it's a horror movie, you know? Yeah. So it sits in this really weird pocket. I basically made, you know...
You created a genre.
the artsy, talky horror thriller. Yeah.
Wow. Who else has a boner out there? Pick up Butterfly from fucking Amazon. It's a genre that's erotic because it's so niche. I know all the hipsters out there who are like, what genre are you into? Oh, I'm in this genre you haven't heard of. It's talky thriller art house.
Right?
Yeah, I haven't even heard of that. Yeah, well, you're not in the scene, I guess. People are in a scene are watching Butterfly every day.
Right, yeah. That's
what is the other part of the lifestyle? It's the Frappuccinos. It's the European cigarettes. It's also, you know, the model girlfriend. You have one vest made of chainmail. You know, it's like, yeah, the scene.
Just for going out, you wear the chainmail. I mean, sometimes you have to because someone's trying to knife you.
And there is nipple chafing. We're not going to lie, but... You know, if you want to be in the scene and know
I like to
obscure
wear,
genres.
I like to wear a silk tunic underneath my chainmail.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's...
Oh, that protects the nipples?
Yeah, and it really helps with the chafing mm-hmm. quite a bit, yeah.
I love it. I like a still half-dead minx. so we...
For a hat, you mean?
Yeah. Just writhing in pain. With a in a bowl hat.
Now
so see, they're like on display.
That's a niche right there.
Though. Yeah. Well, it's not only do I want like minks as a coat. Like that's cruel because you're killing minks. No, I want them still writhing in agony in a fishbowl on my head, so people can. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's not as cruel because
it's art. You cannot judge
art you
the
can
artist.
Mm-hmm. I was actually just I was having that same conversation just last
it's
night.
It's what your movie's about.
That's yeah. I guess you're right. See, there's that art house thing that I was talking
wow.
about.
Wow, I got a half chubs that's on that genre. It's just between so many things, there's cleavage. Mm. You want to just fuck that niche genre?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to do.
Yeah, we met on the show Shark Tank on ABC. We were
that's right.
in the casting department.
You were the most unliked person in
people
the office.
People hated me.
Yeah, you like, really, people were just like, the looks they would give you. Yeah, it was just... It
was, I was bullied.
You were,
but, hold on.
I thought you were doing the bullying. I thought that's what, you know...
There's two sides to every story. You were talking about the scowls I was getting. That's bullying. That's ostracizing. Okay? It doesn't matter where the scowl happened. The scowl happened. Okay? So that's... You know what I mean? Anyway.
Somehow out of that, though, because, you know, you were the least liked person in the entire, you know, office. I was like, that's my guy. I met you the first day, and
yeah,
I was like...
Yeah, you were rooting
I was like,
for the underdog.
I was like, what is wrong with this dude? That's really what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And then we started talking about conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
UFOs, government yeah. conspiracies, and then UFC.
MMA fighting.
Yeah, MMA. So, and those two things, which you are not way more knowledgeable than I am on both of those subjects. and I was really impressed. And I was like, oh, we have that weird thing. How often do you... Because you don't normally meet people who are into MMA who are also, like, reading books and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, no offense. No offense is like the Joe Rogans of the world are
right.
out there. I mean, that guy's freaking awesome.
He loves MMA and he does stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm at.
Right, yeah. So,
but I don't... I'm thinking of also joining Muay Thai in August. I'm going to pay off my credit card, then I'm going to join a Muay Thai gym.
You should join me over at Krav instead.
Krav Maga?
Yeah. Krav Maga.
I don't know. I just, when I see Anderson Silva mess up a motherfucker, I'm like, that is straight Muay Thai.
It is straight Muay Thai, but, you know, Krav is all about, like, how often are you going to be in the ring with, you know, with Anderson Silva? Probably never. But
when he sees me in the gym, day one, he'll be like, what in the shit can this white boy do?
Well, that might be true, yeah, because you are pretty crazy.
And he's going to be like, get me out of here. I don't want to be in this gym right now. I feel intimidated.
The thing with Krav, though, is like yeah. the Krav is, there's no ceremony about it at all, and it's just straight up, like, street fighting techniques that are that are, you know, and it's, you know, it comes from, you know, it comes from the Israeli military combat system, you know, their hand to hand system. So, you know, it's no bullshit.
And, you know, you think Jews can't mess up a motherfucker. No, what a Jew does with Krav Maga, because it was developed by the Israeli army, is they break your arm as they're throwing you into a concrete wall.
Well, there's no wasted movement, you know? Like, you want to... The whole thing with Krav Maga is, like, you're not going to use it in a competition. You're not going to get in a ring and use it. It's for when somebody jumps you on the street.
Yeah.
You want to end it as soon as possible. Yeah. You just want that fight to be over. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? Well, you hit them with the most deadly, effective things that you can immediately.
Yeah.
You know?
And they learn those moves afterward in hindsight of the Holocaust. Nowadays, like, with Krav Maga, if they came at you with, like, Hitler's like, I'm going to throw the Holocaust maneuver on you. One, two, that's a 1-2. They got that covered now. Now they end it immediately with, you know, their fighting system.
Yeah, I would think the Holocaust was more of a 1-2-3.
Oh, yeah, know, that's a problem.
Because, you know, the Third Reich.
Yeah. Yeah. Got to watch out for the overhand Reich.
1-2-3 Reichs, you're out. You know, the Israelis would be better prepared now.
Yeah,
you know, try to pull that shit. You know, they come knocking on your door. You know, and 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, with the police.
Yeah.
You know, and the German, the guard dogs and stuff. Yeah. And you know, and they're met with, like, you know, fist to the throat, and you know, and just flying elbow. You know, that's going to deter the police from, you know, taking those actions. Exactly. So yeah.
And there's no self defense above Krav Maga. We've learned that. here's what I want to talk about. We're going to talk about all those things more. First, I want to talk about meetup. Here's my pitch. I go on different meetups, bizarre ones, get material for stand-up, and then do stand-up comedy. That's my idea for a show.
Oh, that's a great show.
Because I...
it'd be like the way Seinfeld starts out, you know, started out with, like, a little stand-up routine. Mm-hmm. You, in fact, would be making a stand-up routine out of the situation.
And maybe you would, like, see
it on its
20
head.
Minutes of a reality show where I'm just having fun with a weird group. And then, like, 2 or 3 minutes of stand-up. And that's about what the ratio would be, you know what I mean? But you would see the 3 minutes at the end. But yeah. I would have to, you know...
Yeah.
Work it out a few times. Because if I just came up with the material that week, you'd see me eat dick with it a bunch of times, too.
Yeah, well, you might go about, like, how I would go about doing that is I would collect, you know, I would go to the groups and then go in and, you know, join them, collect the material over a period of, you know,
a couple of weeks. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And write those jokes, but don't necessarily perform them. You could jump to the next thing and then start doing that stuff, and you could still be honing those jokes as you go. And then when you get, you know, when you start doing, unless you're doing it episodic, like every week you're going to be doing it like South Park style, where you're just going in which you could, but that requires a lot more time.
Mm.
You know, if you did like 6 episodes,
no, I think you have activities planned. You know, you know that's the whole thing. When you, like, if I went into a Wiccan group, for example. Then I would do, like, 6 Wiccan groups in a row or whatever. And then that would be, like, a week of shooting with different Wiccan groups. Mm. And then kind of see a general thing of what about what's going on with Wiccans. And then, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great idea, except that, you know, and that means you would have to spend, like, a week with 6 different Wiccan groups. So, you know, there's the rub, you know?
You know,
Or who knows what else, you know, kind of, you know, you suffer for your art, but, you know, I guess...
Last night, I was at a official Thelemite class.
I didn't know that was legal in California.
Yes. No, Thelemites are studiers of Aleister Crowley, and they were, you know, they taught me a prayer, and I have it here, actually. It's all about Kabbalah stuff.
Uh-huh.
And basically what they would do is they would draw a pentagram with their fingers while saying these words. Ata, Ayuas, Malthuth. Vegabora, Vegdula,
Wait a minute.
Leolam. Amen. And you would be drawing a pentagram and then walking through that pentagram that you just drew with your fingers.
Hopefully that fuck-up didn't just, like, summon Cthulhu or something.
Oh, yeah. You're all fucked right now because that came in your ear and put a ghost in your brain.
Or Cthulhu. I had
H.P. Lovecraft fan over here.
I was at a film festival in Vegas, I guess 2 years ago with, Butterfly was in it, but I also had another film in it, Ashes, which was, I co-wrote with the director, and it's a zombie kind of film, right? And in the film, I put a little, because, you know, I'm a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan.
Yeah.
And I always try to slide a little something in here or there. And I just had a line about, you know, where they're barbecuing and one of the wives says, you know, something like, you know, you better get out there. He's sacrificing the steaks to Cthulhu. And somebody in the audience after, you know, we did a Q&A after the show. And one of the guys in the audience was like, oh, yeah, I have a question. I noticed that, You name-checked Cthulhu, but the actress pronounced it wrong. It's Cthulhu, not Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm. You found a fellow nerd in the audience.
Right. And I you know, it's pretty funny, but I just said, well, actually, Lovecraft himself said that the name is, you know, unpronounceable in the human tongue. So any way you pronounce it is going to be wrong.
Yeah. You were having a nerd battle up there.
And he just had to sit down, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, don't bring your Lovecraft mythos on me, buddy. You know? You guess I'm the one who wrote the fucking movie. You know?
I got retorts for that shit. You think I didn't
look it up? You know?
This is real. This continues. This is the invoking spell of Satan. Before me, Raphael. Behind me, Gabriel. On my right hand, Michael. On my left hand, Uriel. For about me flames the pentagram, and in the column shines the six-rayed star. You can go on meetup.com and find people trying to summon Aleister Crowley with his Kabbalic cross that you draw with your finger, pentagram, say those weird things with a series of gestures. And it was all very procedural, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Well, go on. Crowley was all about the ritual.
Yeah.
That there was power in ritual. That
I just feel like if you're pretending that you're summoning demons all day, that like you're not. You're just kind of a bum. You're not really doing anything because there's no such thing as that. No one's ever photographed the demon being summoning from drinking blood. It's never happened once. So in order to trick himself into believing that he's doing any work, I think he has to, like, you know, what are you doing? What did you do today, Aleister Crowley? Well, I did my fucking invoking the archangels. I did this. I did that. I did that.
So you're basically saying that he was using it as a scapegoat to be lazy.
What, you know.
Can we go on record? You know? Eric says, you know, that Aleister Crowley was lazy.
You know what?
Yeah. Now this would be good. You should.
He's a pretty prolific writer.
You should bring that up at the meeting when you start going to some of these. You know, you can be just really disruptive that way.
Oh, that's a high.
And then they'll kick you out of the meeting. You know,
that's a high caliber of people that I'm really worried what they would think of me.
Well, they might cast a spell on you. So you
that's
watch,
true.
You be careful with that.
I watched six people cast this spell. Do you know how many fucking Draculas I saw? Zero. I'm not worried about it.
You know what, though? You should use that. It's, I think you should use that quote in Damien Shadows. Or better yet, when you start going to these Wiccan meetings, go in the Damien Shadows get up.
Yeah, and, I was thinking about that.
And then you walk through the door and they're like, oh, one of us.
Yeah. Actually, I went in there and everyone was kind of dressed frumpy. I was wondering if people would be like super glammed out, you know, like vamped out, but no.
Well, you need to find a better group.
Yeah. This was kind of like an academic. The main guy just kind of talked a lot. And what I didn't like about it. Okay, so each person goes up and they do this thing. Before me, Raphael. Before me, Gabriel. with a series of very elaborate gestures. And the guy would literally say things like, when you were drawing the pentagram, your arm curved, try to make it more straight. And I'm thinking, the basis of magical practice is to bend the world with your will. You have a certain will, and this is like where things like The Secret come from too.
Right.
You have something on your will, you have something that you want of the earth, and then you light candles and you bend your will to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are in your head about when you're doing these rituals of how to bend your will to bend the world, and you're all self-conscious about because he's nitpicking on little things of moving your hands around, that cuts into your confidence when you're doing these things,
uh-huh.
which takes your power away from, you know, I think confidence and wanting something and knowing that that's what you want as you approach other people in your life, like, you know, people help you make things happen. So I don't know what magic is, really. So,
well, you know, the funny thing about the if when you strip away all of the hoopla about something like The Secret or really Aleister Crowley's will magic, you know, he was all about the will, you know, and willing things into, you know, fruition. When you strip all of the arcane stuff away from it, though, you're really just left down, you know, it boils down to, if you want something, you should focus your attention on it and then go get it.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, it's like, it's pretty straightforward. If you want to be, a great guitar player, well, get a guitar and start learning how to play it, you know? And if you devote time and attention, if you put more time into, like, you know, that than, say, lighting candles and praying about something to happen.
And showing up to this meeting every week.
Right. Yeah. Just, I mean, I'm just,
what do
I'm
you
a
want?
Big fan of, yeah. I'm a fan of just, like, good old-fashioned get it done, you know, just like, it's, you know, with writing, it's the same thing. You have to sit your ass down in the chair and you have to, you know, type, you know, this. Yeah. I mean, you put out more work than anybody I know. And so you're always working on something, but that's just it. You know, you're always working on something. You're working towards something. And that's way more valuable than any other, you know, kind of hocus pocus, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, also I want to say...
Not that I'm not a fan of magic, you know. I do write horror movies.
I totally agree with all this. It's like, you know, when you're there... You know, a lot of people want to cast a love spell or whatever. If you want to cast a love spell, maybe instead of spending the time it takes to do that, go fucking to bars and try to get your dick wet, man. Try to fucking spit game at bitches.
Or go on this website that you're talking about where you meet up with people.
Here's the other thing I want to talk about.
See how I brought it all back
around? Thank you. Meetup. The first idea I had for a show about Meetup would be like something like The Chameleon Bachelor or whatever. So you try to like research each of the groups that you're going to go to, dress like them, study them a little bit, learn some knowledge about them, and then try to nail pussy in that group. You know,
that's
The Chameleon Bachelor.
Show, yeah.
This is a different show.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's
you should pitch
idea.
Both those shows to different networks. And you can, you know, get them both going at the same
do you think,
time.
But I don't think Meetup would like help sign up on it. I would like they would be a part sponsor. Like, hey, Meetup, you want to get exposure?
They'd love it. Can...
They would love it.
Yeah,
isn't it? I'm pitching this right now. Someone send this to Meetup.
Someone at Meetup. You know, why don't you send it to Meetup?
Yeah, I will.
The only trouble is, you know, if you need to copyright it. Because if you send the idea to them, they're just going to run with it.
Those fuckers. They haven't seen my stand-up, though. I got 7 minutes of thunder right now I can drop on them, and they'd be like, we need this guy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you should maybe pitch them, you know, the idea, like, on a video.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Fuck. So much work to do.
Mm.
So, speaking of other things, Damien Shadows, you were the director of the original Damien Shadows, the pilot.
The original pilot.
Now, right now... I'm going to post episode 20 on Saturday.
I've been waiting for that.
And then the next week is going to be Wilhelm Skeptisch, which I think is going to be the best thing we've done so far. I think Wilhelm Skeptisch, unfortunately, I play Damien Shadows. Listen to me. I want Damien Shadows to blow up. This thing we're making called Debunking Wilhelm Skeptisch is so fucking ridiculous. But anyway, You helped direct it. What was your role? How did, when you came into the project, what did you think, you know?
Oh, well, let's see. The guy who wrote it was a real jerk.
Okay, we're also going to talk about why people thought I was a jerk when I was on Shark Tank. We've just graced the surface of that conversation. Go on.
Well, yeah, so you brought it to me and you were like, hey, I want to shoot this. I was happy you asked, you know. I'd never directed comedy, so mm-hmm. that was new for me. I'm not really all that funny, so I wasn't sure how that was going to go. But
that's not true.
But I was pretty sure you were funny. Although I can tell you, this is the truth, that when I read the original script and, you know, and I was thinking there's no way this is going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, this is going to be really dumb. And then we started shooting and I was like, oh, well, this is actually, you know, maybe better than I thought it was going to be. And I was laughing out loud at, you know, the things, but, and then of course, when the whole thing gets edited together, I was like, oh my God, it's fucking genius. Yeah, it's just the amazing process. And it's not like I was not familiar with that process. Mm-hmm. You know, I've edited and directed and, you know, I mean, I'm an editor for my day job. So I know how that works. But, I was pleasantly surprised. But I think that, you know, not to, you know, blow any too much smoke, but, I mean, you know, I think the key to it was really your performance. Like, all the actors were good, but, you know, it's you, or you're selling that character.
Right.
And that's what I think works about it. So.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, for you, I just wanted a director and, you know, but like for you.
You're the only director I know.
But we got along. Most people hate me if you look at the office statistics. But,
That's true. I have a, like, heroic tolerance, you know, for just bad behavior.
As long as they have some kind of balls and intention behind it, it's like, Jesus Christ.
Well, there's an integrity to your intentions, you know? Like, that's what I think is the important thing.
But you were really helpful where you would just tell me, like, because I can't watch my performance. I don't know how I'm relating to the, you know, we don't have time for me to stop and watch each take, you know? So having you there was very helpful to be like, hey, this is working, this isn't working. Just another pair of eyes. And, you know, we disagreed every now and then on stuff, and then we shot it both ways. But, you know, it was awesome to have another set of eyes, you know, just taking care of. Also, Ted, you know, is just a Ted Andres is such a great DP, and he's very professional,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't want to, like, call the shots of, like, finalize on the shot. So when I have to act and direct, it's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got to run back and forth.
Yeah, Ted's a great guy. I would, you know, I feel like we're doing like, hey, let's promote everyone we know. But,
yeah, I know.
But, you know, but no, Ted, I would hire him any day.
If you are an up-and-coming director or a legit-ass motherfucking director in Los Angeles, let me tell you something. Ted Andres is a monster.
Yeah, he's got a great eye. He's got a cool camera. He's really easy to get along with.
Great attitude. Super professional.
Mm-hmm. And he also, when a shot's not working, you know, he was not afraid to say, hey, you know, this maybe isn't, you know, why don't we try it like this? And, you know, as a director, I love that kind of feedback because I'm not a camera guy, you know.
Yeah.
I'm actually a writer who sometimes directs stuff.
You're a big fan of Robert Anton Wilson.
Yes, I am.
And, so when
devotee, you might say.
Who is this guy?
Robert Anton Wilson is now deceased. He was a writer, probably most well-known for his Illuminatus trilogy. Wilson wrote a book called Quantum Psychology. And to start out with, I think that's probably the best one.
Kind of a book on metaphysics and...
Well, it's really a book on perception. It's about how we look at things and how we see things as a human. And it seems like it's so simple, but it's kind of hard to get. You know, start to, you know, at least to grab the idea that that everything around us is based on our perception. It's our brain and our nervous system that's feeding information and looping back on itself. And so because of that, you can't have a conversation about anything without including the idea of the brain and your nervous system, your what Wilson calls reality tunnel, you know, whatever your reality tunnel is, which is the way you see the world specifically and individually to everybody on the planet. You know, they all have their own personal view of everything that's surrounding them. And because of that, if ideas come in that are outside of your reality tunnel, then you tend to reject them. And particularly if you've signed on to a particular ideology, whether it's Christianity or Islam or communism or whatever, when you sign on to an ideology, then you've sort of given yourself over to that reality tunnel and you've allowed that to be your reality. Maybe your idea isn't the best idea. Perhaps you could look at somebody else's ideas. Perhaps you could start mixing some things up. And I think he also has a concept called maybe logic, which also has to do with quantum mechanics and, you know, Schrodinger's cat and that, you know, that whole thing.
What's Schrodinger's cat?
Well, you know, that's you could tell me more about it. That's the concept of, you know, it's an experiment, a thought experiment, that if you put a cat in a box, why you would do this, I don't know, because science is cruel, I suppose. If you put a cat...
And you broke off its legs, and you smashed its brain with a hammer, but kept it alive, and you put it on a ball on your head. Okay, you put a cat in a box.
And then in a hat. And then on your head. Is that a cat in the head on your head?
It is my piece of art. Judge it only as the visualization and not my cruelty. This is an art piece, stands alone. Its suffering to me is stupendous.
What were we talking about?
Oh, magical suffering! Bring me at peace with my mother. The magical suffering reminds me of my womb because I was malnourished because my mother was starving. Oh, happy suffering. Oh, feeding tube of life. Nutrients are scarce now. I will squeeze some juice into my belly. Now he's Italian.
What?
No, because his mom doesn't eat a lot.
Sure.
Because she's poor.
Uh-huh.
So any little granule he gets in his umbilical cord, he squeezes it down into himself.
I see.
Like a tube of toothpaste to make sure.
I had missed the part where he was still a fetus.
Oh, okay. No, he's saying, but I was a womb. That was the magical suffering I went through. I was in poverty.
I see. Yeah, now it makes way more sense.
And then that reminds me of the boss. The magical suffering of the writhing monkey. So there was a Schrodinger's cat was in a box.
Right, yeah. It's just, the idea behind it is that, you know, if they were to inject the box, you know, with some sort of gas to kill the cat, or maybe not kill the cat, you don't know if the cat's alive or dead until you open the box. And it sounds really dumb, but, you know, the simple idea is that your experience is the thing that decides what the thing is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, until you open the box, you don't know if the cat's alive or dead. It's in this stasis of either or. Mm. Now, it is, the thing is that it is one or the other. It's either alive or dead. But you're not going to know until you actually open the box and look. And so you can't, so this is, has to do with also Wilson's, you know, the idea that you can't know, they're the thing that you're using to know something, which is your brain and your cerebral cortex, is a tool. Just like when you, if you use a tool that measures light waves or energy, rather, it is whether it measures it in waves or measures it in pulse, depends on the machine that you're using to read it.
Yeah.
And the machine that we have to read reality is our brain, consciousness. You know? And so that's the idea behind the whole thing.
It's like Schrodinger, we know. We don't know if the cat's dead or alive, based because we don't know. And he's just, like, turning on the gas and like, he decides what cat lives or dies. It's like, no, we have to keep testing because you don't know if the cat is dead. I mean, that's pretty self-evident. We don't need to test it. Thousands of cats are dying, Schrodinger. We need to keep testing.
He just keeps testing. Yeah. Like, and now we know he's dead. Now we know.
So, and the like, research
okay,
assistant.
Okay, we get it.
The research assistant just walks up to the box with a check mark. Is it dead or is it? And then, like, you look up at the clock of when you found out the information. Right. It's with the check mark.
Oh, it turns out he's not dead. Yeah. Okay, well, that one's good. Not now, dead. Close. Okay, the cat's like, the cat's in there all, like, relieved. Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. I wasn't sure what reality I was going to, you know, come into when they opened up that box.
But in that cat's reality, it's just thinking, meow, I was fed. Box, I'm moving now. Meow. You know.
Meow, poison. Ah!
I wonder if I can get out of here. The humans are friendly. It is weird to think, like, well, what is consciousness? Like, it's that if everyone died all of a sudden, then the... You know, all of those pieces of consciousness that have their eyes on the world somewhere shut off at once. It's almost like there's another realm that they were all living in. They were living in a conscious realm.
By becoming a believer in that philosophy, it automatically makes you also not a believer in it. Because you have to challenge that idea as well.
Then all of a sudden, as soon as you believe in that philosophy, you're very skeptical of your own consciousness and your own perspective.
And I'm constantly making those arguments with myself. There's sort of this duality kind of fighting in I think, at least from my brain of, you know, or how I'm sorting out these things, between Wilson's logic or maybe logic and that kind of point of view. And also... this idea put forth by, have you ever read the book, The Lucifer Principle?
No.
The Lucifer Principle is this book by, Howard Bloom. And, this guy, to my knowledge, he's only written the one book.
I know this guy. Wasn't he some kind of like recording agent or he was in the music industry?
He was a bigwig, like maybe at Virgin or, you know, one of the major record labels. He was like, the top executive.
And then he just comes out and goes, okay, I'm kind of a Satanist, and here's my book, The Lucifer Principle. You want to make it in the music industry, sell your soul.
That's actually not what the book's about.
Go on. What is it about? Enlighten me. I just make things up when I don't know.
Well, I guess he suffered an accident. I think it was a boating accident. And came out of it, I guess while he was recuperating, he started studying various histories and, you know, philosophies and things, and developed this idea from, you know, I'm not saying he obviously pulled it together from various sources and things, but developed this idea of the Lucifer Principle. And the Lucifer Principle is basically how we have to, as humans, we demonize something in order to eradicate it, in order to propagate our own existence, our own species. And he shows it like on a microscopic level, scientifically, about, you know, basically things taking over, and then develops that into the idea as modern Homo sapiens, we use ideas, you know, memes, you've probably heard of. So we use memes and ideas to then get our point of view across and to be the dominant point of view. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's Christianity or communism, it's, you know, or anything else, you know, it's, those are ideas. That's an idea that some guy came up with, you know, or a group of people came up with, and they said, hey, we think this is the way the world works. And that's what we're going to tell people. And so then those people went out and told a bunch of people, and then a bunch of people said, oh, yeah, that works for me. And so then they all started believing in it, and that became a thing, you know?
That's what's weird about Christianity, because just because the most amount of people believe in something does not mean that they're right, okay? And if you are something like a Christian, an American Christian, or a Mormon or whatever, yeah, that's like, that's what you were taught. That's, you know, there's a lot of that word... Mormon or that word, and so it's like this kind of operating system is a Terrence McKenna way to say it. There's you're running that program of looking at the world through Mormonism, and so you put on your bulletproof underwear and you go, bullets can't fuck with me if I got these on. And then, also, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what also Wilson would call a reality tunnel. Yeah. So, you know, it comes back to that as well. And so I guess the difference, or the, not the difference, the argument that I have with myself, and I play out sort of in, you know, in Butterfly, I'm making an argument of that's based in Wilson philosophy. I have characters making those arguments sort of under the guise of, you know, a horror film. But the basic principles is there, you know. So I slid it in there.
Of course, yeah. You want to propagate your operating system because it's helpful to you.
Yeah,
you're like seeing the world like this makes sense to me.
Right.
So hopefully you can give someone, you can enlighten someone who isn't thinking like you are.
And that, of course, then you run into that, you know, the wall then, which is. Bloom, on one hand, you know, Howard Bloom would say in the Lucifer Principle that it's our duty to push our ideas forward. You know, whatever you think your ideas are, you should push those ideas forward. And in your, whatever it is, your art or your, you know, if you're starting a religion or a government or whatever, that it's in your best interest to push those ideas forward. And, you know, how, and then conversely, though, because of that reality tunnel and because of maybe logic and the Wilson influence, you have to also then say, yeah, but your idea is just as suspect as any other idea. And so, you know, what makes you think that it's going to be better than anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Or you know that it's all, your ideas are all bullshit too, you know? And so, like, do you believe your own bullshit? And then if you do, well, then you're just as bad as, you know, the other idiots that you're trying to destroy.
But, yeah. I listen to a lot of Christians talk, and they always say stuff like this in their rhetoric. They always go, oh, well, the reason for that is simple. No, the reason... Okay, let me explain something. The reason for that is simple. It's like, you got one book. That's why the world is fucking simple, okay? When you're looking through everything through that lens, you know, whether it's any lens, whether it's any book, whether it's, you know, you have any guru and you go, you know what, I'm going to filter my life through that person's perspective. I don't know. It's like, I don't want to belong to any of those institutions because then it excludes me from hearing the perspective of other institutions. And the more I do that, the more I think all institutions are bullshit and you should be a well-read person. And, you know, a lot of Christians haven't even read the Bible. Not that you should, because it's awful. I mean, who wants to read that?
Well, I don't know.
Who wants to read Shakespeare? It's awful. It's so boring and pompous. I just want to, like, slap that bitch with a white glove and shoot him in the head and go, stop whining.
Wow. I guess
Shakespeare plays are 5 fucking hours.
I can't get behind that.
Shakespeare plays are too long. They're dreadful.
And you know what? And it's this single idea which made you the most unliked person in the office.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Here's my I'm going to,
you know, it's that kind of attitude, Eric, right there.
I really want to talk.
That loses friends.
I don't know why. And let me say this. And an unsustainable listenership as well, I might add. Statistics are very erratic. It's not like, oh, yeah, we're always coming back for you, Eric. It's like, oh, I like that guy. You know, it's more like that.
Yeah, I imagine you're going to get some big hits on this one.
Oh, yeah. You are wired.
I mean, you Google my name, and it comes up.
That's true. Yeah. You're going to get a lot of hits when this bad boy releases, too.
The funniest thing is, like, if you do Google Edward Romero, but you don't put the E in there, like, one of the most popular Edward Romeros online is this guy who is a serial killer, a murderer of like, young girls. And I'm like, well, because of the kind of movies that I make, I'm like, oh, that's a great association to have.
Oh,
like,
wow. Yeah.
All I need is the FBI getting those files crossed, you know?
Are you the guy who is killing young girls and boiling and eating their underwear and teas and soups and, you know, like...
No, I was the guy making movies about that stuff.
Yeah. all of that stuff. You're sure you're not the guy? Because the description of Butterfly and these
seems
incidents,
like obviously it's the same person. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you have an E. We don't have the E on this. This is just Edward Romero. I don't know what his middle name is. He's a fucking murderer. That's you.
I had a friend in college. This is a, I believe it or not, I had a friend in college.
Did you?
Yeah, I had a couple of them.
Get out of here.
Yeah, but we went to school at Eastern Michigan, which is in Ypsilanti, but it's next door to Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is like, you know, U of M, and it's a big party school. But Ann Arbor, Michigan is like one of the most PC places on earth, particularly like, and I was, you know, I was going to school back in the 90s, and when I'm, you know, dating myself now, but the Ann Arbor police were so nice, and they didn't ever want to like offend anyone, and particularly college students, because, you know,
that's their meal ticket,
right? And one time we got pulled over on our, we were on our way to a party, so it wasn't like we were drunk or anything, but I was with my college roommates, and we were all piled into this car and on our way to this party that night. And we get pulled over, and the cop's like, you know why I pulled you over? Well, no, officer. Well, because you're driving without your lights on. Like, oh, yeah, you know, we just drove like 3 miles or whatever with no lights on. Nobody noticed. And, you know, it's not, this is like 10 o'clock at night, too. So he gets the guy, yeah, I won't say his name on air, you know, for, but he gets my roommate's ID, you know, checks it, and he, you know, walks back, and we're all thinking, oh, man, you know, like, I don't know what we'd even
was
be busted
drunk
for.
Or
no, no, there was he totally sober, and the guy's taking forever though back there, and we're like, well, what the hell's going on? And finally, he walks up back up to the car, and he hands his license back, and he's like, oh, you're not the same, you know, so and so who killed all those children over in, like, you know, such and such county, and we were all stopped, and he's like, I didn't think so, guys. Have a good night. You know, and sends us off on our way. Yeah.
You learned something about your friend that night.
Yeah.
He knows how to keep his mouth shut.
Right. Turns out he was the guy who killed all those children.
No. Okay, wait. We keep skipping over this conversation. Let's really get into why people didn't like me as in the casting department of Shark Tank. Now, for those who don't know, Shark Tank is a show on ABC where different inventors go in front of a panel of rich people and go, hey, I got this thing. You're a rich white guy. I need $6 million to advertise and properly distribute this product. And then, you know, you're going to invest in it. It's a deli slicer or whatever. So, you know, you're listening to business pitches all the time.
Man,
so
Shark Tank is essentially the, it's the American dream in microcosm.
Yeah. Just going in front of venture capitalists going, I want to make my dream business happen.
Right.
I got all the energy in the world. I just don't have the capital. So my job, okay, I was the one who was getting the mail in, okay? Let me say this. So,
Can we legally talk about this?
I think so.
I mean, I still work for them.
Okay. Well, let's talk. We can talk about certain. I don't know. It's public knowledge that you mail in a submission tape.
Yes. That's right.
So you mail in a submission tape, and then that gets processed, obviously, and there's a different, you know, we judge them against each other and try to get the best inventors and whatever
right,
the producers are looking for.
My job is to cut them into awesome, you know, tapes. And
demos.
So basically a sizzle reel for the invention or the business or whatever.
And so this is how we explain.
It's actually my favorite editing job, I got to tell you, honest.
Yeah.
I do a lot of casting editing, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Shark Tank is, well, one, it's like the crew is great, which is funny since they hated you. But but it is a really great crew, and they and the, you know, you get to do the best edits because, like, you get to see the coolest stuff come in, you know?
So, yeah.
Anyway, that said, you know, it's such a great job, and apparently you didn't get along with these people.
Okay,
these very decent people, mind you.
All right, let me break down my side of the story and where I think this animosity came from.
Mm-hmm.
The supervising casting producer, a guy called Scott Salyers, you know, runs that department. That's public knowledge. He told me that, look, in order for us to start editing a person together, a demo reel together, we need to make sure they have all their paperwork. Because too many of these shady characters are giving us half the paperwork and not filling it fully out, and it's screwing us down the line. So, Eric, your job, just to make sure, before you pass it to the next level, before you pass things on to me, just make sure they have all their paperwork. So people would mail in their shit. And the paperwork is fucking tough. It's like doing your taxes. Like
30 pages.
Yeah. So, you know, they would come in and they would, 90% of them would be incomplete. And so I would say to the casting person, oh, yeah, you got to, actually, the person didn't fill this out, so I can't accept it yet until... And people will get really pissed. They're like, it's a good invention. You have no idea. They already have a working concept. It's everything we want. And I said, I'm sorry. It's just, this is what I've been told, is that we can't do it until the paperwork. So I was the fucking paperwork Nazi. That, but he told me explicitly, so this is what I want you to do.
That's why you think the casting department didn't like you?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I was put in a position of being the bad guy. That's my, I don't know, I haven't heard the smack going around the halls, but apparently it's been, there's always constant rumors of everyone going, remember that angry guy from New Jersey?
From season one?
God, I am so glad he's out of the building.
You know, it's so funny because we were just talking about you at the office today.
Yeah?
Yeah, and we're like, you know, I mean, it may have been that I brought you up. And I was like, remember that asshole from season one? You know, and people were like, oh, yeah.
Go on.
No, I'm totally kidding.
Well, what is said? How do you know this? I know a few people were against me. Okay, here's the other thing. I'm not going to name names, but there was a certain person who was also charged with my job who was on Facebook all day. And as the mail would come in, or as the submissions that we had to, she had a tub of work, I had a tub of work.
Mm-hmm.
I was always doing her tub of work
mm-hmm.
because she was doing 8 hours of Facebook a day. I was super stressed.
You want my opinion? And first off, I made up the part about all the scowling.
That's true. That's definitely true. I experienced the scowling.
And as far as you being the least liked person in the office, I may have made that up as well. I have nothing to base it on. But I do have an opinion as to why, if you were having trouble with, you know, people in the office, mm-hmm. it may have been, and I'm just, you know, because I only met you for the first time, you know, and I thought, who is this asshole? You know, like, but I think it's this. I think it's the way that you talk to people, because you have, like, zero tolerance for, like, if you think somebody's dumb. You know, you have, you know, whether they are or not, you know, is, you know, remains to be seen. You know, I'm not saying anyone, you know, in particular. I'm just saying that I've seen in operation, you know, for a couple of years now, and you have very little tolerance for people who are dumb. And so then you talk to them like they're dumb. And when you're in an entertainment business, there are a lot of dumb people that you run into. And so in your attitude is like, well.
You know? Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, that could hurt you.
My
you know?
Common sense explaining seems belittling to people.
Right.
My basic human decency.
There's the tone, yeah.
here's my opinion of East Coast versus West Coast. And I'm glad you brought this up. I remember one time we were playing a board game at your house, okay? And one of the parts of the board game was to rate each other's speeches. So from 1 to 3. And as everyone's making a speech, the other people listen to your speech, and you have to spontaneously speak about something off the card.
Yeah.
So it's like, talk passionately about Vietnam vets or whatever. And then you would try to, you know, get a tear-felt moment or whatever. And you have 60 seconds. People would go, oh, that was only a 2. That was decent, but I've heard better Vietnam speeches. Anyway,
right, sure.
So 2, 1, 2, or 3. At the end of the game, all the cards are passed out. Everything, we're totaling up the score, so you have to look at the score of all your things. Every single person gave every single other person a 3, except me, who gave some people 1s and some people 2s. Because I'm sitting there thinking, I'm not having fun with friends right now playing board game. I'm going, that was not a good speech. You get a 1. Try harder next time. That's just the way I was raised.
Uh-huh.
It is an East Coast thing of being competitive and, you know, uh-huh. scoring according to the book.
Right. You were out for blood.
I'm,
you know, and it was a friendly game of whatever that game is. And you were you were going for the jugular.
When you're playing street ball with your friends, you know, you get a little fired up. You want to dunk right in your friend's face sometimes.
Right. And see this, I don't know if it's an East Coast thing or, you know, an Eric Hollerback thing.
You know? Here's the other thing. You know when dogs, I watch a dog whisperer a lot.
And I thought you were going to talk about dog fights.
Yeah, I watch
a lot. When dog fights?
You know, because I find them beautiful. I either go out to eat or I watch a dog fight and I am satiated by their misery. I absorb it as a plant absorbs the sun. And
we don't know if the cat is alive or dead. We will find out.
Oh, the anticipation of the misery is what satiates my tum-tum. Oh, the pure starvation in the womb. I would push the from the tomb to my belly. Oh, that one room. There were cockroaches in that womb apartment of mine. Early, humble beginnings, my friend. You and dogs are... One dog is fucking up, and one dog is acting crazy. And you watch it on Caesar Milan. And when one dog is acting nuts, the other dogs nip it in the neck and go, "Stop doing that, fucker!" You know? And, "So what are you doing?" And they just kind of smack the dog, and then the dog's like, "Bleh!" And then it gets quieter and just starts going with the pack, you know, at its own pace. On the East Coast, people get... Yeah, it's getting hot in the car. In the East Coast, people call each other on their bullshit. And it comes out, you know, you watch something like The Jersey Shore or whatever, and they're like, "I want to get my point out. I just want to get my point out." But it's like, you know, speaking of perspective, it's like from that person's perspective, they're trying to get their point out. I'm trying to tell you about yourself. And because
that's your Jersey Shore accent.
That is how we reach enlightenment. When you say something really cutting at somebody, when you really break down their life and go, "This is how you're fucking up," and you distill it to a one sentence and throw it in someone's face, that can hurt someone or it can motivate the shit out of them. And because, someone's watching. Someone's watching the fact that I showed up late today. Someone's watching the fact that I didn't do my homework. Someone's watching the fact that I'm lazy and not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And on the East Coast, you get called on that left, right, and center. Try to get... But in the West Coast, no one gets called on that ever. Because one perspective is because they're more balanced personalities. They're more chill. They're more relaxed. They're smoking a little weed. They're hanging out. They're enjoying their life. That's one perspective. But they're inflated douchebags sometimes who are incredibly rude and don't realize that, and you know, just showy bullshit personalities. And they don't know it's possible sometimes that they can be just called out all at once for them. So, you know, from the East Coast, I like to shake, rattle, and roll some things. Like, I like to say something to somebody and watch it break down their paradigm. That sounds like a cruel thing. I got my doctorate in Hard Knocks, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Of taking those shots where it's like, my dad said to me one time, he goes, you know, whenever you're wrong about something, you go alone for a while and you justify reasons why what you did wasn't wrong at all, instead of actually owning any of your own faults. And I remember I cried for an hour, and then I was birthed into maturity at that point. When I'm deflecting or when I'm, you know, I weasel out of stuff and I justify my shitty actions later. Everyone does this.
Mm-hmm.
But to be more cognizant of that and to really deeply analyze yourself and make sure that you're on the right path every day and not bullshit yourself.
Call yourself on your own shit, basically.
No one's getting called on their shit in California. And so when you look at me from an outsider, it's like, "Oh, that guy's a dick." But it's just cultural.
Well, yeah, you might have a point about, you know, as far as people in, I mean, certainly, it can't be in certain parts of Los Angeles and also in the entertainment industry. For
exactly.
Sure. It's a strange mixture out here of people who are really super sensitive to everything, yet they are completely unaware of their own freaking bullshit.
Yeah.
And then get, like, real snobby about stuff or, you know, or treat people like, you know, subservient. Like, I see this all the time in L.A. where, like, in restaurants and stuff where people are just, like, you know, they treat the help like, you know, they're your hired hand or something. And yet they're the same people who are, like, peace and love and you know, channeling crystals and things, you know. And it's like, really? But you can't, like, be polite to the, you know, freaking busboy,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Like, or your waitress, you know, like, that to me is, you know, just, it's crazy.
Yeah, and so if someone's rude to a waitress, but they're Steven Seagal, you might not say anything, because you know, Steven Seagal.
Well, because he'll kick your ass.
Well, and talk about a guy without a sense of humor. I don't want to go after Steven Seagal too much, but it just seems like maybe no one's ever called him on his bullshit, like, to his face, you know. And nor do I think he doesn't know that's possible, you know.
Well, I think that's part of that. I mean, that, what you're talking about is like the, I mean, I don't know, Steven Seagal maybe is a different example, because he possibly, I mean, if he didn't trip over his gut, could possibly, you know, kick your ass, I guess.
With,
you know,
his Aikido.
Right. But, like, we do it. Like, we being, you know, people, I think, put other people on a pedestal. And that's how, I mean, the star system, it's old, and, you know, it goes back to the beginnings of Hollywood.
Yeah.
And this idea that because you're on TV, or because you're, and that's why everyone wants to get on fucking TV, so they can be somebody,
yeah,
because you're nobody if you're not on TV.
Yeah.
You know, or in the movies. And if you are in the movies, then you're somebody, and
yeah,
that somebody needs to be treated more importantly, because mm-hmm, now they're somebody, they're not just you, you know, which is... It's mind-boggling, but we do it, you know, as a society, we do it to those celebrities, and that's why I think people love to see celebrities fall. You know, we love to build them up and put them on a pedestal, but then the first time they get busted, you know, with a hookers and blow, it's like, oh, see? We knew they weren't so special, and, you know, everyone, yeah, loves that.
And then they judge that against their life, where it's like, in their life, they have a job, and they're just watching their wife get fat. And so it's like, I mean, being a celebrity, people don't understand how much pussy is thrown at you. Like, you know, most don't have... If adultery isn't an option, then it's not bold of being faithful, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that's probably in your case, you know.
Absolutely.
Because I know you're a man of action.
I'm an action man.
Yeah. And the action man, the original action man.
That's why some people hate me, because it's like, you know, they just see all this action. So I was in this improv thing called Monkey Butler, and that is a... Okay, I was in UCB before. I've talked about this on the podcast, but I was in Upright Citizens Brigade New York, and they train you really fucking harshly. Like, there was one time where this guy, Jason Mantzoukas, was like, he's a, you know, a well-known improviser, but he was just, after a Herald team bombed, was just screaming at them. And, you know what I mean? Going, look, you weren't listening to this guy. You weren't, you know. And Jason Mantzoukas is a fucking super samurai improviser. And the reason why he's screaming is the intensity of his passion. He's fucking a monster at improv, and you don't get that good unless... You know, it's like...
So you're going to give him a pass then at the table when he's being a dick to the waiter?
No, because the waiter's not improvising, but if the waiter was his improv student and he was, you know, not listening or whatever, he's going to let him know. So that's how he got better. That's how Jason Mantzoukas got better. So anyway, I trained like this, and I was in Monkey Butler going, and the notes were just, I felt too soft. Over and over again, people are getting away with not a strong structure or technique behind it,
mm-hmm,
I felt. And, you know, so I was like, let me do a class that's about, you know, that where I teach UCB style. Where, you know, where it's like, let's learn how the game works. Let's learn, you know, learn fundamentals of improv. Started with 16 people and 8 performed in the final.
Uh-huh. You just cut half of them out.
No, they all quit.
Oh.
Half the team quit.
Well, that's pretty good. It means you're doing something right.
Exactly.
But those the people who stayed were, you know, dedicated.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that, like, and that was out here.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, there you go. And so, I guess that comes back to your point of, like, you know, if somebody says something directly to you of, like, this is what's not working, you have two choices. You can shrink from it, or you can step up to it. Sometimes my reaction to notes can be like, well, this guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, clearly it's right there. But other times, if I'm being honest with myself, I can look at it and go, oh, yeah, well, if I haven't done my job, if I haven't made that scene, you know, what it needs to be in order to get the point across, then I failed and I need to fix it.
Yeah.
You know?
Instead of just, no, I want it to be vague. No, I want the audience to be confused. If the audience is confused, it's like, what are you doing? Are you trying to entertain people? Are you trying to, like, give them a good, like, make a good movie that's very entertaining? Or are you trying to, like, fucking, you know, look at yourself in the mirror and just go, I love every, like, just watching yourself shit, just, oh, everything about my shit is perfect. I'm cutting logs like a fucking champion right now. No, you're cutting log. Your shit stinks.
Yeah, I think that's getting it. Yeah.
But, one note I gave in improv class that I felt like rubbed people the wrong way is I was like, look, improv is not blah, blah, blah. My mouth is moving. I can keep talking. That's got nothing to do with what improv is. Improv is a technique of, like, learning, not forgetting anything that's going on. You're spinning 12 plates at once. You're remembering that your mom's name is Jane. You're remembering that where the table is. And then, like, if you have an improv table and everyone agrees that they're putting their cups down here and they're picking their beers up there, if you pick up your beer from a table, it's an empty beer. That was that guy's empty beer. You have to know all this stuff as every piece of information is established in the scene. You know, so I would hold people to that standard and I would stop scenes a lot and I was fucking tough on them. And I feel like half the people in LA couldn't take a class that was exactly how everyone was trained in New York and everyone took it. So right. I feel like in my, you know, from my perspective or Californians' perspective of me as I'm a dick, my perspective of Californians is like, can't take criticism well. People are live in their bubbles and they don't get called out, you know?
Because
here it's like, your free expression, your free expression. And that's good. It's kind of a hippy-dippy creative. But if you want to make the best shit, you have to have discipline.
Right. Self-discipline to be able to, you know, push yourself to do the best you can do.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I mean,
And where is that, ooh, I need to be free, and where is that you've been sleeping for 3 days and you haven't written anything, you know? It's like, you know, if you're going to be an artist, there's a high level of output that you need to do, you know?
Well, it just reminds me that at UCLA, which is where I studied screenwriting, they have the, you know, best screenwriting program in the country, from what I've been told. Workshop portion of it, like, it was twice a week, you know, you would get together and read people's pages, and you have the professor there who's there to facilitate that reading. And I thought the professors, like, you could tell that they were doing, like, basically, it's a really tough job that they have to have to to get a person to improve their writing, but not destroy them in the process.
Yeah.
Because then they're going to quit the class, and then, you know, it's going to have an attrition rate, which it did anyway, you know. Yeah. They had probably a 50% attrition rate, even with people being really nice. I don't know what the reasons for people dropping out of the course or whatever, but, you know, that was fine. But there were a lot of writers that I just thought, I mean, it was just terrible, like terrible writing. But you can't, as you know, and the instructors have to know that, you know, they have to know that this is awful, but they can't say this is awful. You know, you're a terrible writer. You're pursuing the wrong field. No, they have to kind of couch it in a way that's, you know, supportive, you know, to the person. I think that could ultimately be damaging because somebody can string somebody, you can be strung along for a long time thinking, oh yeah, this is good. You know, because we're already self-deluded enough, you know? I mean myself included.
Myself included. You have to be deluded to think that you can make a living from, you know, the fucking fantasy world you can create. Or just anything I write is enough to be, you know, entertaining to people.
People are going to find this entertaining.
When you hear most people talk about a dream they had and it's boring and fucking you're like, oh, that's your deal. You know, you're fucking weird. None of that made sense. So there's a Firefly's your mom. I don't get it. How is that relevant? I don't know why I don't get along with people.
I don't know, because you seem like you had it all dialed in. I guess that's the takeaway here is Eric doesn't get along with people.
No, I love people. I mean, obviously, I love that those observations, though, and I think they're fun and funny. And I remember when I was a kid, also, me and my friends wrote battle raps against each other one day, and one of them was...
You got any of those on tape?
My God, I hope not.
If you do, you should open the show with that.
No, we're going to close the show with a little Jed's Dead, your band, you're the front man of. We're going to talk about that in a second. Let's talk a little bit more about me first.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what this show is about. You, like, you bring guests on so you can then talk about yourself. Like, oh, I get it. I mean, I've picked up the rhythm of the show.
It's an endless loop of narcissism.
Here at the end, I finally discovered that, you know, that's what we've got here.
Also, my Aunt Colleen said something hilarious one time. She's like, oh, my God, enough about me. Anyway, what do you think about me?
Right. I was just about to use that same Aunt Colleen.
Aunt Colleen. She's always getting around. What am I saying about my aunt? With her jokes.
Right, people, the jokes are popular.
They're getting around.
Yeah.
Love you, Aunt Colleen. I don't think she listens.
And also, she sleeps with a lot of men.
Moving on. Just leave it like that. Moving on. Let's talk about Jed's Dead. You are the front man of... And let me tell you something. There's a very underground way to live forever, okay? Not a lot of people... Only people in the know how to have your name cast in the most... Yeah, a Hollywood Walk of Fame can suck my dick. One of your songs, the Jed's Dead song... is in the jukebox of the cinema bar.
Yeah, well, the whole CD is in there. Really.
Oh,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's the whole album.
What?
I know. Yeah.
Okay, so I've seen you crush shows at the cinema bar. Oh, well, and that's the best way to see this guy on the day-to-day. You can only watch Butterfly so many times.
Right, yeah. Once you have learned all of the dialogue by heart and, you know, can quote it back, then
and it's like in your dreams, yeah, and you're just thinking of that movie.
You're like, wow, you know, I need to move on from Butterfly. What else
has
E. Romero done?
Tomorrow, I'm jumping back into Butterfly.
Right, yeah, tomorrow, you know, we in Philly, so
what can I do today?
Thing.
How can I feel close to this director? You can go... down to the cinema bar in Culver City, and if he's not there, just put Jed's Den in the jukebox, and then just hug the jukebox and sob.
Yeah, well,
and realize that greatness of the boombox is being blasted against your genitals, and then you start getting freaky on.
Right,
and it
feels
a lot like love.
I gotta say though, if you get freaky on the jukebox in the cinema bar, Rod. The owner, he may physically remove you.
He has a stick for that.
Yeah, he does. It's like a giant spatula that he just kind of peels people off the jukebox with, and then throws them out.
And you know, there's statistics that of whose song is on the jukebox when people are fucking it, and he has to get the stick.
Uh huh.
Always Jed Dead at 100%.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. We've got some rabid fans, I guess.
It's
you know?
The subliminal messaging. I can't talk about that, but let's just say. You know, it's addicting, like cigarettes.
Yeah, we definitely put some back masking on the album, you know, in a Beatles tradition.
We're going to play some Jed's Dead at the end.
If you play it backwards, you can hear me divulge secrets that I learned in the government while I was working for them.
Oh, yeah, you had top secret clearance.
Yes.
Any alien shit? Did you get down on upper levels of the military?
Yes, but I can't talk about it.
Okay. I thought you were going to spill your guts right now. You got to buy the album encode it in the album. Play it backwards.
Yes.
A plainly speaking Edward Romero is going to tell you exactly where they hid the bodies.
Yes. And we certainly, we aimed for that, you know, on the Judd's Dead album. You know, we're subliminal backmasking that would start a cult. I mean, that's that was the initial idea behind the album. You know, let's start a cult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how do we? How can we make money and tax free? You know,
let's
start a cult, and the cult will be the band, and the band will be a tax write off.
Uh huh.
And when the dollar bills started flowing in, and we were like, hey, we're a church.
Yeah, and then. You know what you hear when you play your music backwards?
It sounds a little bit like Ata,
I was Malkuth, Vega Bora, Vega Jula, Leoam, Amen. And then on the second track,
right,
it goes Yodahaya, Adonai, Eeth. And then you say, before me, Raphael, behind me, Gabriel, on my right hand, Michael, on my left hand, Uchael. For about me flames the Pentagon, and the column shines the sixth red star.
And then when you draw the Pentagon and a pentagram.
I did it again.
See, now who's being subliminal?
What? The government's in my brain. When you draw the pentagram with your finger and then you poke through it while you're saying this nonsense, what if you do it like counterclockwise, it's invoking, and then clockwise, it's banishing. So you invoke the spirit, then when it's gone, then you banish it. So you got to go in and then out. A lot of procedure. Got to know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like very close to a choreographed dance routine. It's like a very, like this was the, it's very like a dance. You're drawing this thing, you turn, you draw it the other way. It's very militaristic and like, you know what I mean? Rigid.
Mm-hmm.
But you're, and then you have these things to say.
Well, you hope it's rigid because if your lines are curvy, you're going to get yelled at. But, but then again, being from, the East Coast, you probably are, you would appreciate that yelling because you want to get your shit straight.
Here's the thing.
If you're going to be doing it, you may as well do it.
If you're going to invoke Satan,
yeah,
fucking dot your pentagrams.
Dot your pentagrams.
Cross your pentagrams.
Yeah.
Fucking that 90 degrees,
mm-hmm.
bitch. She was talking about how her back hurt and stuff, and it was physically hard for
about
her.
Satan?
No. One of the people who was there.
Oh, okay.
She was having trouble because it was physically hard for her to stand and make the X's as well.
Uh-huh.
And they kept kind of...
Didn't have anything to do with her diabetes. Right.
Well, she's trying to cure it via Satan. But you can't just... I learned when I was a kid. You know what I tried to do? I learned that if you sell your soul to the devil, you get what you want. So I went, okay. And I went... And I tried to sell my soul, and I know I'm bringing this back to me, but that's mm-hmm. the point of the show.
Yeah, right.
I tried to sell my soul, and I'm like, Satan, take my soul and let me levitate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I said that. And when I didn't levitate, a lot of the deprogramming came off. That was the first big seed of Christianity.
Right, because you were basically saying, I'm going to the dark side now, and if there's anything to this, the dark side will welcome me.
Yes.
And when it didn't happen... But here, I could tell you this though, William S. Burroughs, he once said that ask a preacher and they'll tell you that any soul is worth saving, but there are only a few souls worth buying. So if you get what they call the devil's bargain,
right,
consider it a compliment.
Right, right, right. If someone goes, hey, sell your soul. But I think that's...
So it might be just Satan didn't want your soul.
I guess so.
Or he could be like, if I just wait a few years, because I got lots of time, if I just wait a few years, Eric's going to give his soul to me for free anyway. Why do I need to give him anything? Why do I need to give him levitation? Yeah. He's going to do it for a shot at stardom.
Yeah.
In Hollywood.
When he's 34 right. All right, I'll sell my soul for this commercial.
Right, selling it for peanuts. He probably was like, I got time with this guy.
Planners.
Yeah.
I go nuts for peanuts. After all the fucking years of improv getting yelled at.
Uh-huh.
Nuts are yummy foods.
Mmm, these are some tasty nuts. Yeah, that, I could see you doing that commercial. And then you're like, and then Satan pops up and he's like, ha, I've got you now.
I had a much bigger contract next year, but you blew it. You signed too early. And now you're poison for the agents in the studios. Yeah, the nut boy.
And he's like, and don't even think about bringing that stand-up routine down here to hell, because we don't have time for it.
We saw your fail.
We saw your 7 minutes.
Overrated.
Man, and you know that's got to hurt. Because, you know, if there's, you know, I mean, you don't know, you can't really recover from that as far as, like, how do I improve when Satan tells me I suck, you know?
Well, I was bashing on Satan's minion, Dick Cheney, a little bit, so... I think he got pissed off that his right-hand butt boy was getting exposed. I was laying some truth on them.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about Jed's dad. I was in your house a second ago. I was hearing some early cuts of some, oh, what's that beat? That sounds like the new album being put together.
Uh-huh, yeah.
When is that dropping?
Well, it keeps dropping and dropping and dropping. And it feels like, you know, as the... I think drive-by truckers would say that thing's been falling so long, it's like gravity's gone. It's just floating.
Whoa. Bluesy.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been... Here's the thing. So it's our second album. As your listeners all know, that the first album is available, you know, you can listen... I mean, it's available everywhere. You can get it on the iTunes or the, you know, order it from the Amazon or
Whoa.
Any of those places.
Yeah.
But... You had mentioned it's on the jukebox in Culver City. If you
that's
go to the cinema
place.
Bar,
yeah.
I just, you know, as a plug for the cinema bar. Even if you just, I mean, if you're listening out there in
podcast land,
you know, and you're in Los Angeles, do yourself a favor and go to the cinema bar. It's in Culver City. It's got like the best bands that you're gonna hear in town. I mean, well, I should say if you like Americana and you know, more of a folk blues rock scene rather than, like, you know, a Hollywood rock and roll kind of scene or a pop scene.
Yeah, you want to see legit shit, you go there. You want to see some, you know...
You want to see some bullshit, go to the House of Blues.
Yeah, you want to see some Justin Bieber processed, horse-tranquilizing fuck shit, go to the House of Blues every other weekend. Some fucking frauds who are no talent hacks. Every single one of them. So you should go to the cinema bar and check out some real artists.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I was getting at. So yeah,
there are some haters out there.
Some people they just don't get it.
They just get mad for no reason. And I'm sick of it.
So, yeah. So yeah, we're working on the second album. We've been working on it for like 2 years. We ran into... Here's the trouble first. I take full responsibility for this. The first kind of attempt to lay down the second album, I was like, hey, let's try to do it as a band, like all at once. You know, record it in the studio, just like, you know, live in the studio to lay the tracks down. You know, like the Beatles used to do on their first, you know, like 3-4 albums. And then we got done recording the entire album that way and soon realized that we weren't, in fact, the Beatles and could not record an album that way. I mean, it was just a disaster. And so we went back to the drawing board and started tracking it like a sane person would do in a modern world where you have, you know,
the drummer just listens
devices,
to the,
you know?
A beat and lays the whole beat down of the whole song, then the guitars, then the vocals,
right?
And you mix it perfect,
right? Yeah, we decided that was really the way to go, which is kind of where we're at now. Matthew, who's my keyboard player and also happens to be my best friend, but you know, he's mixing and doing all the hard work. He's kind of our aside from being our piano player and trumpet player and singer.
The editor, composer.
Yeah, he's pretty much, you know, the backbone. He's the brain and the spinal column of Jed's Dead. I guess
Matthew Thies, give him a shout out.
Yeah, right.
He was also in Suppressed Inventions. So did you see that?
That's right. Yeah, you should check that out. Yeah.
Okay, go on. It's that guy.
Oh, that guy with the
Lyme disease and that weird futuristic looking.
Well, so the Lyme disease, right. Because you know you could check that out on the other thing. The Lyme disease is one of the reasons why you know we've had to scale back on the band. Like we hadn't been playing out live because Matthew's just not physically capable of doing it. Mm-hmm. So we were like, well, let's just concentrate on the album and get that done. We do have a show coming up, which will be our first time playing out in probably 6 months. Coming up in June 29th at the Cinema Bar. There's a thing going on there called Toddfest, which is is a Cinema Bar patron, sort of everybody's favorite Cinema Bar guy. I guess is a good way to put it. A friend of mine Todd Kivy is a he's moving to Austin, and so the Cinema Bar is throwing him a big, going away party, and it's just like a bunch of bands are going to be playing. So, like, really, if your listeners really want to go to the Cinema Bar, that would be a great weekend to do it, because there's going to be like a dozen bands playing over the course of 2 days, mm-hmm. and they're going to be like all of Todd's favorite bands, so should be a good old time.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's the first time we've played out in a while, so. It's going to be good.
Yeah. Go and see them live. They will kick your dicks off. I know that's not good advertising, but you'll grow back a bigger dick because, when Jed's Dead kicks your dick off with their music, their boots have regenerative bigger dick powers.
Yep. Yeah, that's how it works. Hi, Mom. If you're listening.
Ata, Iowa. Is your mom Christian?
She is. Yes.
You know how Aleister Crowley would summon the devil? Malkuth Vegabora.
Right. Now you're just being mean.
Nothing happened. And if you have enough Jesus juju in your body, it's probably going to be fine. Speaking of the jujus, they got Krav Maga.
Wow, you brought it all the way back around to Krav Maga. Nice. And that is our show, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, I think we're good. How long have we been recording? I just kind of lose total track of time. 28 minutes, that's good.
All right.
We probably made this happen.
I think there's some good stuff in there.
This has been Highway Fucking Diaries. I got a stand-up show at Flappers May 14th, and also May 12th, we're going to show some Damien Shadow shorts at Flappers Main Room. So check that out. Go to aircollerbach.com, appearances. Check out Jed's Dead. They're playing in a festival.
It's 29th of June.
There you go.
At the Cinema Bar in Culver City. Yep, Jed's Dead. You can find us all over.
And our links are below. See you later, motherfuckers.
Well, I told you that I'd find you if you ran as far as Texas. I'd stand up toe-to-toe against your father. You threw your boots in the car and you busted my guitar. You said, baby, I wouldn't even bother. Well, I do confess, started out a mess. Everybody knew we'd fall apart. My only regret is you were smiling when you left, and I didn't have a chance to break your heart. When I saw how you were drinking, I guess I should have known you were in trouble. But I focused on your hair and pretended not to care. It's hard to see the light when seeing double. I do confess, started out a mess. Everybody knew we'd fall apart. Oh! Texas, I'd stand up toe to toe against your father. You threw your shit in the car and you busted my guitar. You said, baby, don't bother. Well, I do confess it started out a mess. Everybody knew we'd fall apart. My only regret is you were smiling when you left, and I didn't have a chance to break your heart. My only regret is you were smiling when you left, and I didn't have a chance to break your heart. Didn't have a chance to break your heart. Didn't have a chance to break your heart.